Hello, readers. My name is Jason Jeffries, and this is Bookin', brought to you by Page 158 Books, Wake Forest, North Carolina's trusted independent community bookstore. Please navigate over to www.page158books.com for all of your literary needs. Once again, that's www.page158books.com. My guest today is R.A. Cramblett. He is the author of Probably Lives in Tahiti, The Parker Chronicles, both of which have received stellar reviews. The novel we will be discussing today is his first crime novel, Like Printing Money, which is published by BC Publishing Incorporated. Bob, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Jason. Great to be here.
It is an honor to have you here. And first, before we dive into this novel, a couple of questions about yourself. You were playing a guitar in your author photo. Are you a musician? And if so, what do you play?
I'm a hobbyist, and I play guitar and sing, and mostly cover versions of different songs. I love pop songs from the 60s and the 80s, you know, Elvis Costello, the Beatles, the Beach Boys, things like that. And I took lessons for 10 years or so from a local guy named Mike Krause, who is a stellar guitarist. And so I wrote a few things myself, but never was able to regrettably join a band or put a band together. So the things I did were some things around the Cary Downtown Farmers Market and things, gigs like that. Mm-hmm. And so I had a very brief and not particularly fulfilling career as a musician. And I haven't played recently. Mm-hmm. I guess the writing has become all-encompassing for me, but I hope to get back to it.
Yeah, right on. Thanks for that information. And I'm digging the Who shirt that you have on, which our listeners can't see, but I can. Very cool. Well, next, I'm leading you down a road here, so follow me here. This is a self-published book. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, so this is a self-published book. And my question is, why? And what I mean, Bob, is you and I are acquaintances. We're friends on social media. I don't know you outside of that, which may change going forward now that we're both in the same geographical region, but I have followed your publishing exploits, and you have people who are extremely enthusiastic about your books, more so than most others who have published their own books. And listen, listeners, this book is great, and that's with a capital G-R-E-A-T. The writing is fantastic. Your allusions are fantastic. The plotting is fantastic. If I were a publisher in your genre, I would be knocking down your door to get the rights to this thing. So can you tell us, Bob, about your publishing journey?
Yeah, well, I certainly tried to get all three books published. And, you know, I tried to get an agent, and I pitched small publishers, and nothing. You know, basically, I think it was, I had no name attached to it. You know, I didn't have any reputation of doing something else. You know, if I would have done something in music, perhaps, maybe that would have generated some interest in my writing. But unlike other people in the Triangle and other areas who have written books for the first time, I didn't have any platform already established. I mean, what I had done before was writing for trade magazines and doing kind of technical writing. A lot of articles and things like that, a lot of e-zines, e-books and things like that for corporate clients. But when I did this, I did my best. I mean, I was I had a little bit of career in public relations, which you would think would keep me in good stead as far as trying to pitch a book or any kind of product, but I wasn't able to break through. And so I had a lot of background in both writing and in editing. I've been an editor almost as long as I've been a writer. And that dates back to probably elementary school age. So, I mean, my first publication ever was a little handwritten newsletter in the sixth grade that I charged people a dime to read and took it from them after they got finished reading it. In the background, when I grew up, I mean, if you were editor of a newspaper or magazine, whether for high school, college, or whatever, trade publication, you had to do everything pretty much. I date back to hot type, and I wrote stories, I edited stories, I edited my own stuff, I edited other people's stuff, I did a layout, I did oversaw production and all of that. So when I couldn't break through with any agent or any publisher, I just decided, well, I know how to do this and I'll do it on my own. So that's the way that panned out. For better or for worse, I think for worse, I would love to have a publisher. The thing that's been hardest about this whole journey is being have to go out there and promote myself endlessly. That takes up a lot of time and a lot of energy, and a lot of it's negative energy, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, if anyone's out there listening, you need to give this book a shot. But Bob, I will say it's my experience that authors that are even published through the bigger houses and some of the larger indies are also out there doing their own promotion. Most publishers have kind of cut that out, unless you're the type of author who doesn't need their promotion, then they will promote you. It's kind of a catch-22 situation, but we digress. Let's jump into this novel now, this fantastic novel, Like Printing Money. Bob, can you take a moment to set this story up for our listeners?
Yeah, the story is about the main protagonist is a private investigator who has been given an assignment to follow a person of interest, and she doesn't know why exactly she's following this person who seems to be above board in all respects. And she's the chief operating officer for, or chief financial officer, excuse me, for a 3D printing company based in Baltimore. And in following this person, she witnesses a kidnapping. That was related to a person the chief financial officer was meeting with. And so the actual kidnapping kind of leads to a lot of other complications about things that are happening within the company, and including a use of technology for some nefarious means that could be dangerous if it gets in the hands of the people it's intended to get in the hands of. So it's a lot about Baltimore. It's a lot about characters with ambitions that they want to fulfill, frustrations about not being able to fulfill it. And it's basically a character-driven book. I think it has enough plot to move it forward, but basically I'm interested in characters and motivations for what they do and what they don't do, and how did it come to the point of having to make these life-impacting decisions, based on challenges that they didn't expect to happen to them in their lifetimes. So I think it's kind of a sociological novel based in the guise of a crime novel.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Bob. Next, can you tell us about Baltimore as a setting for this novel? Many people are only familiar with Baltimore through The Wire. Tell us about Baltimore as a setting in Like Printing Money.
Well, yeah, I think the Baltimorean, Like Printing Money, is very similar to what where Baltimore is at right now, and kind of in a frustrating place for people from there and people who are invested in the city. I've lived in North Carolina for 34 years, but I'm still a Baltimorean, and I follow things that are happening in the city, and a lot of times with a lot of trepidation about, the things that are being said about this city from the outside. And those of us who come from Baltimore, even if we move away, maybe we're even more invested in Baltimore than people who are actually living there sometimes, because we're looking at it. We're from the outside, but my father's still alive and he lives in Baltimore. My sister, many of my friends, and you see things happening in the city, a lot of which is touched on in the book, the demise of the working class. People who worked blue-collar jobs but made enough money to be able to afford a couple cars, a house, education for the kids, to seek a better living. But then there's all these people who have been left behind by the dearth of blue-collar jobs. And that's dealt with a lot in the book, what people are doing within their environment now and how they are either transcending what they were given when they were born and raised, or not being able to equal what their parents did and being frustrated because of that. When I was growing up in Baltimore, I mean, you could have a job at Bethlehem Steel, you could have a job at GM or suppliers to those companies and make a very, very good living. You could be a cashier at Giant Food and make a great living with great benefits. And of course, all that kind of service area and the manufacturing jobs where you make big money, that's gone away for the most part.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for that answer, Bob. Next, a company that plays a large part in this novel does they're involved with 3D printing. Why choose a 3D printing company? What does a 3D printing company do, and what are they doing in your novel?
Well, 3D printing is a technology. It's also called additive manufacturing sometimes. And what it's meant to do originally, basically the process is you take a computer file and you feed it into this 3D printer, which could be the size of, say, a refrigerator or so, and depending upon the size of the object being printed. But it then takes this, and it's either it could be a vat of liquid that can be cured with a laser, or it could be powder that is cured by a laser and built up layer by layer until you have a part. And originally, those parts were plastic type parts and not very durable or anything like that. But in probably the last 15, 20 years, now you're able to do parts with materials that can approximate steel in their strength, but be more flexible like rubber. I mean, parts that are an amalgamation of different materials that create properties that never seen before. Like you can do things that they call lightweighting, which is basically taking something with the strength of the original part, but maybe 50% of the weight, which has great ramifications for aerospace and anything where you're trying to save fuel or energy. Part of it too is to make processes more efficient. Take assemblies that might have required 10, 11 parts being melded together, and because of the capabilities of 3D printing, you can make it as a single assembly with kind of geometries that you cannot replicate any other way. So this has great ramifications for like replacement parts, instantaneous replacement parts, new types of products or parts that are lighter weight, have more tensile strength, and things like that. So It also has a lot of ramifications for what is called reshoring. You know, we know what it is to outsource things, and in reshoring, they're trying to bring that manufacturing back into the United States, almost like what we used to have as a society where everything was produced in the neighborhood in which you lived, in the region in which you lived. So there wasn't all this overseas shipping and things like that. So this has great ramifications for industry and for creating jobs. But unfortunately, a lot of people kind of center on the negative parts of it, and that is the ghost guns and things like that, and the perception that it eliminates jobs, people in assembly and things like that, which in reality, it should be creating jobs because more things can be manufactured close to the source of the marketplace. So I just think it's an intriguing industry, and I had written about it for different clients for about 10 years ago, for 10, 15 years. So I was pretty much involved with it in its nascent stages until now when it's getting adopted into the mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for that answer, Bob. Listeners, we're going to take a short break here for a word from Libro FM Audiobooks, and then I will be right back with R.A. Cramblett. The Bookend Podcast is brought to you by Libro FM Audiobooks. Please navigate over to www.libro.fm and enter the promo code Bookend, that's BOOKIN, to get one free audiobook and support your favorite local independent bookstore. That's Page 158 Books in Wake Forest, North Carolina. Process. Libro has the same books at the same price as the largest competitor out there. You know the name, but instead of supporting the Big River, you'll be supporting your favorite community bookstore. I'm back with R.A. Cramblett, author of Like Printing Money, which is published by BC Publishing Inc. Bob, I want to ask you a question about your sports fandom. I know that you're an Orioles fan and an NBA basketball fan. How does your sports fandom color your writing? You have a great line about a pitcher in chapter one. You make allusions to Giannis Antetokounmpo, et cetera. What's the connection there?
I've been a sports fan all my life. And, you know, it obviously, if you're a fan of sports and you participate in sports, it colors your view of the world. And I think a lot of things that sports did for me, obviously how to work as a team, how to accommodate other people. And in my case, you know, I played basketball in high school and I ended up playing basketball for a few years at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC. And, you know, it was really my first, I went to a high school that was almost overwhelmingly white and lived in a neighborhood that was that way. And so this is my early, and I love black athletes. You know, when I grew up in Baltimore, there were the Baltimore Bullets were still there with Wes Unseld and Earl Monroe and Gus Johnson and these great players who went on to Hall of Fame careers. And so they were inspiration all the time. And of course, on the baseball side, Brooks Robinson, Frank Robinson, Cal Ripken Jr., Eddie Murray, Jim Palmer, all these greats. And so, you know, this colored a lot of how I grew up. I love reading sports writers. And we had a lot of good ones in Baltimore. I'd say some great ones. And, you know, it informed my reading, it informed my view of life. And, you know, when you play with other people, even if you're the best player, you see something in another person on your team or the other team who can do something that you can't quite do as well, no matter how skilled you are. I mean, you know, even Michael Jordan, I'm sure, appreciates the talents of certain other guys in certain other areas. And for me, that was always a good thing that you'd be able to learn from other people, and that there's always something to improve upon. And I think that kind of informs my writing, that, you know, I read fairly widely as well. And, you know, I think to do that well, you have to take in a lot of information from a lot of different sources. And being a team member and being a member of a league or playing sports at that level, you know, you find out a way to share, that you should be a sharer, you should be a learner, you should be somebody who exchanges information with others. And that only makes you better. So I think all along the line, and of course, there's all the cultural things that go with following sports. And so some of my characters are there, and, you know, they are involved in following sports and participating in sports and learning a lot of lessons that I did, and lessons on their own. Because when I start with these characters, a lot of times they end up going in places where I didn't anticipate at all. You know, I have my version of them, and then, you know, they take on added significance or lesser significance. But I think they all have to have a story behind them. And it might not all be revealed in the book, but to me, they all matter. You know, everybody that's in the book, whether they're a central character or not, to me, matters.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Bob, not to sidetrack us even further, but quickly, you know, I know you're an Orioles fan. It's a fun time to be an Orioles fan. I also know you follow the Hornets, and I grew up a Charlotte Hornets NBA fan since 1988. I recently lived in Colorado for 2 years, where I was able to go to the NBA Finals, and it was remarkable watching the Nuggets, who play like a real professional basketball team, after watching the Hornets for many years. Do you think, Bob, that the Hornets will ever be a championship caliber team?
I don't know. I don't think they've made the investments that they should have. And I don't think they've taken themselves seriously enough. And, you know, since you've been following them since 1988, I'm sure you recognize what it was like in those early years. You know, the excitement around it was sellouts every game. And now it feels like that a lot of the fans are going out there to see the visiting team. And I kind of went through that with the Washington Bullets and then the Washington Wizards until I got tired of following them, that they just weren't making a serious commitment to having a competing team. And I always thought, I think the Hornets are where the Wizards have been, and it's the worst possible spot, that you're good enough to not be absolutely horrible, but you're not bad enough to get that first round draft pick that's going to make the big difference. And when they did get it, it was a bad draft year. So, you know, you have that kind of thing come into play. But, you know, I think they need an owner who is very serious about this, because I think Charlotte can be a franchise. If you look at now the NBA, look at Oklahoma City, you know, who would have thought that they could be a powerhouse, or Sacramento, or all these secondary markets that are performing at a very high level, Milwaukee, another.
I think, you know, As a fan of the Hornets since they became a franchise, there's a lot of romanticization of the Alonzo Mourning, Larry Johnson Muggsy Bogues teams, et cetera, which were a lot of fun. Their best team, the most likely team they had to win a championship, was Baron Davis, David Wesley, Jamal Mashburn, et cetera. And the team that we have now, it's not the Hornets. This is the Bobcats, who have rebranded as the Hornets. But hopefully these new owners that just took over from Michael Jordan will run it like a basketball team instead of a business, and or both, ideally. Well, thank you for that answer, Bob. Back to your novel, like printing money. Your character, Buck Boyd, believes that the nation, the United States of America, was built by men fueled on alcohol and drugs. Can you give us some context for this belief and elaborate on it, please?
Well, Buck is one of the guys I kind of alluded to further earlier, rather, about the demise of the manufacturing industry. And he's a guy who feels like he's entitled to something. You know, his grandfather worked at Bethlehem Steel when they were paying the big money, and everybody had a career there, pretty much a job for life, unless they totally messed up. And his father had that, but by the time Buck became of age, those jobs were gone. And, you know, he's working at minimum wage jobs and everything, and he thinks he's better than that. And he blames minorities. He blames the gay trans population. He blames everybody but himself. And he thinks that especially his city, Baltimore, and his state, Maryland, is just going down the tubes. And it's because of, he thinks it's all the liberals giving away jobs and not being able to create a good environment where working class people can make money. And, you know, he has reasons in his mind, very legitimate reasons for believing that. And, you know, his whole perception of himself is that he's above what is happening to him, but he just can't catch a break. So he's trying to make his own break when the novel begins.
Yeah. And also, Bob, this character, Buck, he makes a comment about smartasses saying oil and gas aren't good anymore. And I want to just use this as a springboard as we understand the character Buck's motivations a little bit. But I'm hoping, Bob, that you can comment on this type of belief, because I've run across people who are extremely upset about EVs, electric vehicles, because they don't use oil and gas. And it reminds me about folks, reminds me of folks who have their emotions so tied up with like coal in West Virginia. Why, Bob, do people care so much about the oil and gas industries when there are easier, more sustainable means of producing energy available to us in 2024?
Well, I think in the case of Bob, it's because his parents, his grandparents, his whole family was pretty much predicated upon fuel-based industries, the steel industry, General Motors. All the big employers just about in Baltimore were fueled by oil and gas. And so for him, that's the basis of the economy. That's the foundation of a good economy and a good life. You take that away, and he doesn't have a platform to stand on. And he resents that. You know, to him, these industries were what made America great. And the people who were trying to dampen down those industries and replace them are enemies of people like him, whose family was predicated upon those gas and oil being powerful economic generators.
Yeah, absolutely. That's understandable. Like coal, you know, I guess sometimes you have to choose your family, your ancestors, what they used for their livelihoods, versus, you know, your grandchildren being able to live on a sustainable planet. But, you know, decisions, decisions. Well, Finally, Bob, I want to circle back to music. Bernard Jamal, who's kidnapped at the beginning of this novel, is in a trunk. He is 6'6", the same height as Michael Jordan, and he hears in the car his kidnappers listening to Highway to Hell by AC/DC, if I'm remembering correctly. And my question, Bob, is what assumptions can you make about a person or a collection of persons when you find them enthusiastically rocking out to AC/DC?
Well, I think the two kidnappers involved, one was a former football player and who's been injured and now is addicted to opioids. Is an actress, she posits herself as, but she's working at a Royal Farms convenience store. And she has a burgeoning cocaine habit. And I don't know why I came up with the fact that they would be listening to it, but definitely the guy driving the car, the ex-football player, he would be listening to AC/DC. And Bernard, who's in the trunk, by the way, I had to ask a guy, he's in the trunk of a Lincoln Continental. I had to ask a guy, would a 6'6" guy be able to fit in the trunk of a Lincoln Continental? And my friend said, who owns a Lincoln Continental, said, yes, we could fit a whole family in there. So yeah, that's just, when you come up with these characters, then you start to build on the cultural things and what they listen, your version of what they listen to, what kind of food they eat, what they watch on television, what they read if they read, all kinds of the characteristics that fill in the blanks and make it a fully blown character and just not a cardboard cutout.
Yeah, absolutely. See, that's the kind of research that I can appreciate, Bob, and that I think publishers can appreciate too. And thank you, Bob. Thank you for writing this wonderful novel, which has a sequel in progress and which deserves to be published by a major publisher. If anyone's listening out there, please take my word for this. You need get in contact with me, or I'm sure you can find Bob on the internet. We're going to make this happen. You need to jump on this immediately. Listeners, I've been speaking with R.A. Cramblett, author of Like Printing Money, which is published by BC Publishing Inc. Bob, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Jason. The time really flew by, and pleasure to talk with you.
Once again, I would like to thank R.A. Cramblett for joining me. Copies of Like Printing Money can be ordered from www.page158books.com. I would also like to thank Libro.fm Audiobooks. Please navigate over to Libro.fm and enter the promo code BOOKIN, that's BOOKIN, in the promo code space to get one free audiobook and support your favorite local independent bookstore in the process. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this